Back in the 1960s, the FBI targeted civil rights leaders, anti-war groups, and women's movements, all in the name of domestic security. These secret practices led to a Senate investigation, which found that the Bureau went beyond monitoring these movements. Agents and informants infiltrated civilian groups, recorded private conversations, and tried to damage the movements through smear campaigns and harassment. The bottom line? The Bureau needed reform. Part of that reform, the Senate committee recommended, were better guidelines on how to legally conduct investigations. The FBI codified its practices, but these rules were largely kept out of sight to the public. That is, until now. Welcome to The Breakthrough, the podcast from ProPublica where investigative journalists reveal how they nail their biggest stories. I'm Annie Waldman. This week, we speak with Cora Currier, a reporter at The Intercept who got leaked copies of these rulebooks. The documents detail the Bureau's secret guidelines for agents and informants, painting a complex portrait of the FBI's inner bureaucracy. For the first time, the public can find out how the FBI is supposed to do its job.
I have written about the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, and their attempts to use science, most people say dubious science, to create a profile of what an attacker looks like. So counterterrorism generally and some of the pitfalls of domestic counterterrorism had definitely been a focus for me. And I started getting some FBI documents this year, and that caused me to really drill into like what the way in which the Bureau has changed in the years since 9/11. So I had been doing quite a lot of reading and research and calling on former agents and talking to people about what the FBI's mission is now, how it's changed since 9/11, and you know what their current operations look like, because there's been a lot of focus on sting operations and a little bit less on this general trend in the FBI towards intelligence gathering.
How did you get your hands on the FBI rulebooks?
I wish I could say, and explain how it happened, but I can't. Throughout this series, throughout the projects that I've based on documents, you know, if we get them via Freedom of Information Act, you know, we're totally transparent about that, but there are instances where we just can't say where we get them. And this is one of those.
While the idea of leaked FBI rulebooks may sound exciting, Cora says that was not her first impression when she received the documents.
I guess the first word would be disappointing. You get a pile of secret documents and you start paging through them and you're looking for what hasn't been revealed and what's new and some secret program, and a lot of what you encounter is bureaucracy. You know, in one of the guidebooks that we had, we actually had the FBI has released a heavily redacted version of it. So we were able to sort of compare what was under the redaction marks in one version versus the other. And in some places, you know, they'd redacted things inconsistently. I'd see something that had previously been redacted and been like, oh my God, that seems super problematic. And then I'd look elsewhere and I'd find it unredacted, you know, that had already been public, or, you know, that they'd redacted something that was just widely available in other forms. The over secrecy can actually set you up for disappointment because you're expecting all this secret stuff and then you turn out it's not so exciting what's under the redactions.
Since the beginning, there has been no single external statute governing the FBI, and the Bureau has tried to keep it that way. Instead, it operates under a multitude of hidden internal rules, which are updated from time to time.
The first ones are from 1978, and then they were updated periodically with new rules. And the most recent ones, the ones that are still form the basis of these guidebooks, are from 2008, the last year in the George Bush administration, which set out the post 9/11 FBI. They created different categories of investigations. They set up the rules. And I talked to a few people who were involved in the first drafting of that book in 2008. And, you know, it was controversial because on the one hand, it was an expansion of the FBI's powers. It was codifying some practices that had developed since 9/11, which were different than what the pre-9/11 FBI had done, really showed that the FBI had become an intelligence agency.
Did you know exactly what you had when you had received them?
The first thing I did was that, after some wrangling the document itself and having trying to make it text searchable and dealing with pages that were messed up and things like that, you know, as I went through and I compared the redacted version to the unredacted version. And so I personally went through, you know, almost 700 pages comparing where the redacted parts were and making my own copy that was marked so that I could have a single reference with the other documents, the counterterrorism guide and the informant guide. I looked everywhere to figure out, is this something that's public? And, you know, I was trying to do that delicately as well, because particularly with the counterterrorism policy guide, I couldn't find any public evidence of it. You know, it wasn't in Google, but which doesn't always mean it doesn't exist, right? So, you know, that it's not public. So I just delicately asking people if they'd heard about it, you know, lawyers, former FBI agents, people who've worked on it. And so that was kind of the first process, was just figuring out, okay, what do I have and you know, what's new? And, you know, is this something people have been looking for?
Cora turned to LinkedIn to help her find former FBI agents. She knew that if anyone would know about the secret rules, it would be them.
I think what was useful about this is I wasn't asking them to talk about, you know, active investigations or secret programs. I was asking them basically, you know, about rules, about policy, and they all know these rule books. You know, they have to live by them. And some of them, I found often that kind of coming at it from a bureaucratic angle was helpful. You'd be like, what about that, you know, when you had to get approvals? And that would often just get someone off on a tirade about their least favorite supervisor or something. When you talk to people about office politics, often that is a way to get in and actually end up talking about substantive things as well.
The narrative of the rule books didn't have a human character driving it. So Cora took an alternative approach to telling the story.
We wanted to make these documents a public resource. Obviously, we're not WikiLeaks, right? You can't just dump a bunch of documents. We couldn't just say, hey, we got these FBI documents here, everybody go at them. You know, we needed to do the journalistic work of going through them and figuring out what's in the public interest and what to highlight for people. We wanted these to be reference documents. The lawyers that I spoke to as I was working on this project were like, oh my God, this would be so useful. This will help explain future things, you know, that I want to be able to refer to this. People who've studied the evolution of the FBI and constitutional law and stuff, you know, were super fascinated by these documents. So we really wanted them to be a reference for journalists, for lawyers, for scholars. So that's why we decided to kind of put the documents front and center, and we ended up coming up with this process of sort of annotating the documents. And when there were stories that didn't quite rise to a feature, so that we couldn't pull a kind of news feature out of them, there were some places in the documents where we did write news features, but elsewhere we would do these short annotations of the documents, kind of saying, here's an interesting thing that we noticed. And we also hope that as the documents live on our site and people come to them and specialists go through them, that they might, if they bring something to our attention that we didn't realize the significance of, we could add an annotation to it.
Cora spent months poring over the rule books, and she was near publishing. But then she went to the FBI's website to double check and found something that made her panic.
There was one moment towards the end where I was like doing fact checking, I was going through and reading all the last bits and things. I needed to fix a link or something, and I went to the FBI's public FOIA page to get the public version of the Diog, and discovered that they had, while I'd been reporting on it, and I, you know, just hadn't looked at their FOIA site in a while, they had published a newer version of the document that I was working on, and the main one, but still. You know, and I just like panicked. I was like, oh my God, they, you know, we've already gone to them at comment at this point. Are they trying to undermine the story? Did they publish this on purpose? And you know, it was no, they already had it up for 2 weeks. I just hadn't looked. But I panicked because I thought that all of this work we'd done on the rule book would be invalidated. Stayed up all night comparing the new version with the old version and seeing where pages had been changed or updated. And in the end, there was very little that had changed. The new version was basically a different pagination. There were like a few pages that had changes or where, you know, a redaction looked different or something, but nothing that we had focused on and nothing that substantially changed our reporting, but it threw me for a total loop and kept me up all night. And also, I think when you're deep, deep, deep in a project like this, you know, you start to think that all this is common knowledge, right? Even if you find that something's been reported before and you think it's the end of the world, but like, that little detail never rose to anybody's interest. And, you know, as long as you acknowledge that it's been previously out or whatever, it's not going to, it doesn't undermine your whole story, right? Because you are baked into this topic, but your readers aren't and the general public isn't. And it's still worth doing.
So what exactly are these rules and what kinds of implications do they have for the public? I asked Cora to come up with the three most important guidelines that people need to know. First on our list was the FBI's rules for handling online investigations, from digging into someone's Facebook page to developing sources in chat rooms.
They can have unlimited interactions with people who are not the subject of the investigation, right? So if they're looking at a website, a forum, because a person that they're interested in is on it, and they want to look like a normal commenter, they can chat with you or me or whoever happens to be on that site. And, you know, this feels less controversial if you're talking about, you know, a I love ISIS message board or something. But, you know, I think when it gets into the realm of Facebook pages, right, or public news sites or places where you're not expecting to that commenter that you're in, you know, a Reddit page, or you're not expecting that the person you're in a fight with is, might be an FBI agent or informant. So they have unlimited comment. They can unlimited interactions and communications and postings and all of that. That's a concerning thing, because I think people just don't realize the extent to which they are operating online. And similarly, if in the course of those, you know, they're not supposed to collect intelligence as part of those communications, unless, but if they decide in talking to you that you're worthy of investigating, they can then open something up on you.
Next up, so-called assessments.
So an assessment is something that was created in 2008. This is one of these post-9/11 changes that was codified in these rule books. It was basically the FBI's way of saying, you know, okay, if we get a tip or a lead, or, you know, we're interested, we have kind of a common sense interest in something, right? They would open an assessment, which is means that they don't have to have a specific factual basis to suspect someone. There doesn't have to be somebody calling in with a particular allegation about somebody. It's just kind of a general tip. And with that general concern, they are allowed, like I said, to go through any public database, private databases, other government databases, check the CIA and NSA records, which, you know, so that would include surveillance derived overseas without a warrant. They can task an informant to collect information on people. And then all of that ends up in a file, right? And so they retain these records of assessments for quite a long time, even if they close them. But I think that what's really concerning is the fact that they can do this on a very low threshold, and then they can retain that information and use it in other investigations.
And third, when the FBI wants you as an informant, they have a lot of tools they can use.
There's a whole category of assessment that's about recruiting informants, and agents have even more powers when they're looking at someone to be an informant. So this is someone who they don't think has done anything wrong necessarily. You know, they can also just decide that they think this person has access to information or could provide intelligence on a threat or somebody else. They can open an assessment and someone do all of those checks, all of, you know, those name checks and database checks and physical surveillance. They can go through their trash. They have the power to do what's called a trash cover. And that's basically to look for information that could be used as leverage. We found that informants could be paid portions of civil forfeiture, so things that are assets that are seized could end up with an informant. We found that informants could be paid up to $500,000 a year, depending how much they're getting paid, requires a higher level of approvals, but they can make a lot of money, you know, which is something defense lawyers are constantly bringing up. But, you know, I think that all in all, these documents and others that we've reported on show that, you know, they really are able to put a lot of pressure on people to become informants. They really can dig into people.
Any rules that you found surprising?
There's a long section on watchlisting on the no-fly list, and how a lot of what was in there was already public. But there was one little note in it that described this thing called a silent hit, which is when you mask the fact that somebody's on a watch list. If you're running someone's name and they are on the watch list, it's silent. They don't actually show up unless the right person is running the name. And one of the reasons that they gave for this is if they're investigating someone with access to the watch list, so a member of law enforcement, a local police, you know, a local sheriff, for example. And what the FBI guide actually said is that they were doing this because of known active links between right-wing extremists, militia, white supremacists, and sovereign citizens. The FBI guide actually said that they often have identified active links to law enforcement officers. So basically, this was a rule that was put in place because of the FBI's significant concern about white supremacists and other domestic extremists infiltrating law enforcement. And it was sort of an aside in the rule book, but a kind of alarming admission.
So now that we've gone over some of these rules, you've probably already asked yourself this, but How well do you think the FBI has been following its own rulebook?
I think that there's probably a lot of difference between field offices, and depending on, you know, you've got these mega offices in big cities like, New York, Miami, D.C., right, with heavy counterterrorism programs and stuff, and probably a lot of oversight. And then you have smaller offices, right, where particularly where this counterterrorism mission, you know, might be more problematic, right? What does the Tucson, you know, FBI office doesn't have a lot of terrorism problems to look at. And so how are they deploying these tools, and, you know, how appropriate are the use of these tools? And I think that's a really important question.
This may seem like an obvious question, but why do you think these rules aren't public?
We went to the FBI with heaps of questions about, you know, how the substance of the rules, and also to let them know that we were going to publish the rule books. You know, they initially said, don't publish any of it. You'll be helping the Russians. You'll be helping the Chinese. This is all counterintelligence. You're helping the criminals. And we sat down with them and ended up having actually a very productive dialogue about what if we published in some of the rule books, what would actually put people in harm's way? Rules that could be used to, like, test if someone was an informant, right, which could put somebody in danger if there was a question that they thought that they could ask to reveal whether someone was working for the FBI. So there were things that we held back and that we thought were genuinely sensitive, you know, not top secret or anything, but sensitive. And, you know, I think that there's, in all the intelligence agencies, there's a predilection for secrecy. They have a tendency to keep things secret if they can. But I think in much of this, I think it's super important to be able to know what their standards are so that when they deviate from them, we can point to the rule and say, you know, how is this being applied? It's kind of funny because they're actually kind of proud of this book, you know, at least at the headquarters. You know, they think that it represents their own best intention to voluntarily put rules on themselves, and that we think that they should be there for public scrutiny.
So something that we have been talking about a lot on the podcast is Trump. Is there something in the rule book that you can see his administration really taking advantage of?
I mean, I think we really do have to be alert to how assessments, for example, are, you know, how freely they're authorized and for what purposes. I think we need to look very carefully at the infiltration of religious and political groups because, you know, this is something that, you know, while it's been done in the Obama administration, and it was definitely done under the Bush administration, you know, there was enough pushback on it that the FBI is very careful about it. But, you know, all it takes is a switch in policy for that to become more freely authorized and accepted. I think that, again, informant pressure, paying attention to stories of people who say that they have been pressured to become informants. I think that the use of national security letters, which are these subpoena-like orders that they go to get certain kinds of communications records and financial records, and they don't need a warrant, they don't need a judge sign off, they're internal to the FBI. And those were misused under the Bush administration. There were huge scandals around the use of national security letters. So we have a very recent precedent for abuse of those. And so, you know, I think we just need to be alert to the way these things are used because a lot of it is to their own discretion.
Why do you think this rule book was created to begin with? And why do you think they still hold weight today?
I think that it was, you know, an acknowledgement that the FBI needs rules, right? That it, in some ways, it's kind of, you know, CYA, cover your ass, right? Like if you can point to, you know, well, I followed this procedure and my supervisor signed off on it and I filled out all the correct forms and, you know, the paperwork actually protects the agent, right? It means that there's a paper trail every time they get approval to do something. It can't come back and bite them if it blows up. So I think that's a major motivating factor for the Bureau. You know, and then I think there is a good faith side of it where they, you know, are genuinely trying to impose limits, both constitutional limits and also, you know, additional limits on what they can do, acknowledging their previous history of domestic abuse. And I think also there's places where they want to codify the practices that they want to codify, right? You know, they want assessments, right? So they want to have them in writing and they want to get them down. You know, I think once they've become, you know, established practice and they're written down, they're harder to take away.
And once the practices are written down and opened up to the public, the agents and the Bureau can be held accountable by their own rules. And we have Cora and the rest of her team at The Intercept to thank for that. Find links and more information on Cora's reporting at our website at propublica.org/podcast. You've been listening to The Breakthrough, the podcast from ProPublica where investigative reporters reveal how they nailed their biggest stories. Our producer is Kate Brown. Our engineer is Tim Kramer. Our executive producer is Celeste LeCompte. Our theme music is by Mirelle Antoni, and I'm Annie Waldman. Next week on The Breakthrough, Jessica Huseman talks to two New York Times reporters on leaks from the White House.